what I'm going to be talking about today is Windows Azure Storage. So anything, pretty much anything that's cloud-related data, I'm going to be talking about it here. So I'm going to be going over a very wide breadth of different data abstractions and paradigms and when to use which one, and as far as different types of solutions. Anyway, I'll probably start with introducing myself for people who haven't been talking to me all weekend here. My name is Tyler Dirksen, not Dorkson, and I'm a cloud solution developer. Thanks. At Imaginet, my Twitter handle is Tyler_GD. That's probably the best way to get in contact with me, but if you want to read about some stuff that I'm working on and things that I've dealt with, you can go to my blog at blog.tylerdirksen.com or just tylerdirksen.com. It'll still get you there. And so... Hey guys, come on in. And so, yeah, so I'm a cloud solution developer for Imaginet, and so I'm not a professional speaker. I actually do code and work with a lot of this stuff. I've been working with Windows Azure Storage since it was in, you know, preview or soon to be released, and it's really, really, really compelling stuff. So, Pure Imagination is a very social savvy thing here. And you can tweet purely imagine on Twitter or use the hashtag WinAPI. Or you can thank my employer, JustImagineIt, at JustImagineIt for sending me out here and sponsoring the event. And so here we go. If you want to actually tweet about this particular session, this is the sixth and final session of the Cloud Track. So CLD6, WinAPI are the two hashtags you can use. And then I have on my Hootsuite, I'll get your tweets later and I'll contact you if you have any other questions and or just contact me on Twitter. So we probably touched on a ton of different things in Azure. One of the really great things about this cloud platform that I really love is that it changes all the time. They add new features and change features constantly. So like if you don't look at it for a couple months, you know, you have to kind of learn new things. It's tough with demos though, because you know, like you open up an old sample application, it's like three versions behind. It's a little bit tough, but I really like learning new things all the time. Also, there is a huge amount of services for almost anything that you'll want to do with servers or in the cloud. It is available on Azure. So pretty much anything that your head can come up with as far as a solution, you can use Azure for it. What I'm actually going to be talking about today are the items that are in blue. So big data, just a little bit. I'm going to be talking about Hadoop, database storage in SQL, and other basic storage mechanisms that are really crucial and They're kind of the underlying base of your applications. So big data, right? So what kinds of... has anyone ever worked with a big data framework before, like Hadoop, MongoDB, Or what are some of the other ones? Ellie, nothing? DB2? No. You made me say that, and it's on record. That's terrible. Anyway, so, yes, big data is also known as NoSQL data. It's non-relational. It's document-based. It's primarily used for huge data sets. So something like Twitter and Facebook, where they're getting like tons and tons of data, and they have marketing companies like chewing on this data all the time and doing massive analytics on like huge sets of data. They're doing it in NoSQL or big data solutions. A lot of these solutions are a lot more distributed than regular SQL solutions. SQL solutions have a primary like person or a load balanced set of servers that take your request and process your request. Big data solutions like Hadoop have non-traditional types and newer technologies where they actually kind of split the problem into a distributed algorithm, and they actually have like a grid of computers that will crunch away at the numbers, right? So it's a much more distributed system for doing data analysis and performing data operations. So when you're actually going to, you know, take data and put it in the cloud and you have to, you know, churn away on a ton load of data, I want to say something load, but whatever. And you can use big data solutions like Hadoop on Windows Azure in order to do that. So other than big data, which that was basically what I wanted to touch on, it's there. Not a lot of people that I've actually encountered will use it because it takes a very specific set of problem domain in order to justify digging into big data. And there are some people that are really nuts on NoSQL and big data, but for the rest of us that are building fairly basic applications, you know, social applications, some of the hackathon people that are building applications, we have a lot more simple, run-of-the-mill, let's say, storage solutions at our disposal. So there's four main storage constructs that I'm going to be talking in this particular talk. The first one is the newest that got added to this talk just recently. So SQL Server in a virtual machine. So previously, you probably heard the term SQL Azure. This is a little bit different than SQL Azure. It's SQL on Azure, right? That's usually the kind of difference that I put on there. Lots of people from Microsoft don't call it SQL Azure anymore. They call it Azure Database. And then the virtual machines, they call SQL on Azure. But there's these two first blocks that are actually different. And they're fundamentally different from each other. The first one, SQL Server on a virtual machine, is for, you know, people that have a very specific SQL application where they actually need to manage the underlying server structure. They have a backup or store structure that they depend on, and everything like that. But then if you don't actually depend on having to manage the actual real server or real server cluster, you can use SQL Azure Database, which is basically data as a service. Whereas with a SQL Server, you actually get the entire server. With SQL Azure Database, what you're actually getting is a schema, right? So for those that understand Microsoft SQL and how that whole thing works, underneath the overall database, there's a DBO schema, and you can create other schemas. What they're actually doing to abstract your data away from all the other people that may have data on the same SQL Azure data structure is that they give you an individual schema to work with, which means that you're dealing with regular T-SQL database structures, logic. There's fairly little as far as T-SQL programming that you can't do in SQL Azure. So it's very, very good if you wanted to get some SQL-based solution up and running really quickly and have it scale and not have to worry about scaling. And so the two other ones are more fundamental kind of storage mechanisms like table storage and blob storage. The difference between SQL Azure or other SQL instances and table storage is that table storage is non-relational. And it will handle really, really large data sets as well, kind of like big data. But you can't actually have a foreign key. You can't add more clustered indexes. You basically have one clustered index or two columns that provide your primary key, and then that's it. Two primary key columns and a timestamp, and then you can create any other columns you want. But it's very large, scalable, fairly unstructured data that you can put in table storage. And then blob storage is probably the simplest of all the storage mechanisms because it's basically a file system in the cloud. If you have a solution or a website that writes anything to a file and you want to now put that solution in the cloud, you want to make that server stateless, right? So you can scale it up and down at will. So you can't actually save anything on that server. So you actually have to use blob storage to actually save it somewhere else in the cloud. So that was just a brief overview of some of these, but I'm actually going to start with talking about SQL on Azure. So SQL on Azure is the next iteration in A next iteration in, you know, how you can host SQL. So essentially, you can do physical and virtual. And now SQL on Azure is actually an infrastructure as a service or like a hosted virtual machine system. So we actually had a virtual machine talk yesterday. And so this SQL on Azure is actually built on top of that structure. Then platform as a service would be kind of the SQL Azure where you're actually consuming a service or somewhere in between platform as a service and software as a service. But what I'm going to be talking about right now is actually hosting SQL Azure on infrastructure as a service on a VM. Let's see. Yeah. So they actually, the authors of this particular talk, kind of register the SQL Azure database as a platform as a service. But from physical, virtual, and information infrastructure as a service, those are all actual real Microsoft SQL Server installations, right? So SQL Server on a virtual machine, what kind of capabilities or why would you actually want to, you know, install SQL Server on a VM and use that? You have full capabilities of SQL Server. In SQL Azure, you can't do things like file stream, right? Whereas hosted SQL Server, you can do file stream. With SQL Azure, you can't do regular backup and restore in the normal functionality. There's other options for that. But if you have a requirement on the regular good old backup and restore, you kind of have to do it in a hosted SQL Server machine. So one of the main things is that it's a low TCO you can basically forklift existing applications that use SQL and not have to worry about what switching to SQL Azure may do to those applications. It's very, very similar, the T-SQL, between regular on-premise or hosted SQL and SQL Azure, but there's still a risk that, you know, it might have a negative effect on your application. So that's why lots of people, you know, some people anyway, go towards hosting SQL. And it's possible that your application is just not compatible with SQL Azure. For example, if you wanted to host a SharePoint environment in the cloud, the SharePoint environment kind of has to have a SQL Server sitting right beside it, right? And it doesn't support the Azure SQL. The one thing, so it's kind of a good and a bad, is that you're actually managing this infrastructure, right? But you are on the hook to actually patch the machine, upgrade SQL, manage SQL, truncate the logs, do all of the other SQL management kind of thing. Nobody's going to do that for you. Now it's your machine. You are in charge of it. So what are some of the common scenarios for using SQL Azure, SQL Server in a virtual machine or SQL on Azure? So when you're moving existing, we already talked about that. When you want to do dev and test, for example, you want to spin up a SharePoint environment and just try something out, right? The SharePoint environment requires SQL, or you have some other third-party system that you want to just install on a quick little environment that requires a full SQL instance sitting right beside it, then you can install SQL Azure or SQL on Azure here and use that. Backup and failover. And to the cloud is also capable with doing SQL on Azure. So you can do kind of like a syncing process, a SQL sync process, backup and restore, and you can just restore the application onto the cloud if your data center blows up or something like that. It's lots of the hosted services in general, hosting virtual machines in the cloud, provide a lot of this functionality that you see here. It's not just SQL on Azure, it's basically the ability to host a VM for a specific purpose. So what does this actually look like? Let's see. What does it look like? Struggling. So this is the Windows Azure portal. So I don't have any virtual machines right now, but there's a variety of different things, like you can create websites, mobile services, cloud services. You can create SQL databases on SQL Azure, other storage mechanisms that we'll talk about later. But what I want is actually a virtual machine. So if I can hit new, and I want to hit a virtual machine from gallery, and obviously, so what I actually have here is a number of out-of-the-box images, right, gallery images. So some of these are kind of interesting, right? Already some people's minds are kind of tweaking a little bit and say, hey, there's a CentOS Linux distro. There's a SUSE Linux, Ubuntu Server 12.4.1, and OpenSUSE 12.1. There's different Linux distributions. You got Windows Server 2012, Windows Server 2008, and the BizTalk Server 2012 R2 CTP. You can spin up some BizTalk environment if you want to play around with that. But what we actually want to do is use this Microsoft SQL Server Evaluation Edition. So it starts off with an Evaluation Edition, and it's up to you to actually upgrade the key to your production license on SQL Server. I don't know why my images are not working with this thing, but. So this will be my virtual machine configuration. Win8 SQL. And this is the same for creating any virtual machine on Windows Azure. And if you're at Bruce's talk yesterday, you have seen that. So usually if I was doing like more or less a production SQL Server, I might pick more than just a small, but I'm just going to get this going with a small core at this point. I'm doing a standalone virtual machine, so the DNS name is win8sql. I don't have to put the same one in there, but I just will. Oh, never mind. Tyler D SQL. Oh, come on, really? Toronto. No way. I have to pick like a unique name, and this is just freaking me out already. Guck. Yes, I don't know. So I'm picking different things like I just wanted in West US. The virtual machines can only go in certain data centers currently, but they're upgrading the other data centers to support the virtual machines. They have to flatten their network architecture to provide for the amount of actually throughput that goes through the network. It was a very, really cool blog post on that recently. Pending. Oh, come on. Let's see. Tyler GD SQL. There is no possible way. That is, what did you do to me, Atlee? This is all your fault. These are not the, yeah. Yeah, I think my internet connection got died. There we go. Can I have that? What's that? Does anyone have that hacker thing? TRS guest. Thank you. That was like the worst time in the world to have that happen. Yeah, I know you do. All right, I'm just going to log into this stuff again. So hopefully this will work this time. And if not, I blame Atlee. From gallery. There we go. Now I actually have images for all this stuff. That's probably a good sign. Should have known. Tyler DSQL. Actually, the virtual machine name, it doesn't have to be unique, so I'm just going to call it SQL. And this is normal stuff. No availability sets. So there are options for load balancing and stuff like that with virtual machines. It's not as easy to do as websites or platform as a service, cloud services. This actually might take some time, so I'm just going to switch back to my slides, and then we'll talk about that. So that's basically all you need to do, right, to set up a SQL Azure machine. As soon as that gets up and running, I can click a button and get a remote desktop endpoint to access that machine, and then the SQL is already installed, right? I can start opening ports or configuring databases or just access it using SQL Server Management Studio or something like that. So how is that actually different than Azure or SQL Azure database? So this is actual data as a service that's provided by SQL Azure, where you don't actually have your own machine. You're actually using one of a number, a very, very large number of SQL machines that are in like a huge cluster and everything there. So what is a SQL Azure database? It's a relational storage. One of the main things compared to an IaaS or SQL on Azure is that it's fully managed, right? You don't have to manage this SQL database. So there's kind of two sides to the coin as far as DBAs and SQL goes. There's people that manage the backups and restores and log truncation and all this other stuff around SQL and the infrastructure of the database. And then there are people that manage the schema and the stored procedures and all of the actual functional components of the database. So here, the infrastructure of the database, the log management and all that stuff, is actually managed by Microsoft. In their data centers, they upgrade the things, they worry about online times, and they give you an SLA of 99.9%, and make sure that their data servers are online and ready for you to use. You just consume a schema, right, and a database where you have add and remove and query and maintain data. You have full locking and you have practically full T-SQL support, but you just don't have, you know, the underlying infrastructure support. You can't do backups. You can't do multi-database queries. Well, not really. And, you know, you can't do some of those other IT or infrastructure-related tasks related to SQL. It's all managed. It's all ready to go. One of the greatest things about having a fully managed SQL data service is that it's scalable, right? You can throw a ton of data at it and a ton of requests at SQL, and the teams behind the scenes will worry about how their clusters work and how they're actually scaling the system. There are ways that you can kind of use federations, which I'll talk about in a little bit, to split up your table so that it makes it easier for them to actually scale out. But overall, they manage the scalability of the database, not you. Now, one of the main things is that lots of people are like, well, I don't really want to, you know, implement a new data structure or, you know, change my data services layer. It's the same deal. Like, you access it with the same technologies that you would regular SQL. You have full capability of using popular frameworks and popular tools like SQL Server Management Studio. Not even just the brand new Management Studio, but 2008 R2 and higher. And you can use SQL Server command line utilities like SQL CMD. Obviously, you can't throw backup options at it, but you can still use the command line tools in order to do that. Even different things like DB Artisan and the data modelers and stuff like that. Like, it's practically regular SQL. So let's actually look at how to provision some of that stuff. Hey, look, my thing is stopped. Anyway, that's my SQL virtual machine. If I switch over to the SQL databases, earlier when I was doing a talk on connected applications, I have a PartyDB database that I was put together. And so I actually have a database here that's already sitting on a server. I didn't pick that name. I didn't just type in a bunch of guck. That actually came out that way. And so that it's just the way that it is. This database is actually in North Central US. SQL Azure is supported across all the databases or data centers in Azure. So what I can actually do here is, again, using my handy dandy new, I can say I want another SQL database. I'm going to quick create one, and it's going to be called, you know, last session. And it's already on the server that I have here, and it's creating me a SQL database. The edition of the database is going to be the web edition. You can also scale it up to the enterprise edition, which supports space up to 150 gigs of data. That's kind of the maximum right now of SQL, but if you did have more data than that, you can still kind of talk to the people at Microsoft, but they just don't have a scale that goes above 150 gigs that anyone can just use, right? Like, it's not a really, really hard line, but it's something that you actually have to talk to some of the people in the data centers about if you want to cross it. So I can go to this database, and I've got a couple of options here. One of the main ones is that I can manage the allowed IP addresses that have access to this database. It's actually specific to the data server, so this is the server that both of these databases reside on. And this is my current IP address right now. And that IP address is already on my list of allowed IP addresses. And one of the main things is that in the Windows Azure services here, Any of the Windows Azure services or websites can access this SQL Azure database. But if I wanted to access this SQL Azure database from my on-premise environment, I would need to add the IP address of that on-premise environment to this firewall rule, essentially. Let's see. Databases. So I'm going to go to the PartyDB because it actually has a little bit of data in it. And let's see. I can actually go to the manage URL. And this is just a nice little Silverlight portal. And I can log in with my admin user that I set up when I created the database server. Ooh. Oh, come on. I blame you. And anyway, you can actually use this, or you can actually use SQL Server Management Studio. Oh, apparently I'm on a different IP address right now. Yes, that's probably why. Oh, never mind. Okay, this is not going to work. But anyway, you can manage your SQL Azure database using, you know, like I said, the variety of different tools you have at your disposal. It's a very, very easy to use database structure. And definitely if you're just kind of starting up something, you know, like a hackathon or something, and you have, you know, a few hours left and you want to store some data online and you're used to using SQL, then you can easily set up a database and then use SQL Management Studio and create some schema and go from there. let's see. So yeah, I already have my last session database up and running, and it went even faster than my nice little virtual machine here that apparently seems to be stopped. Anyway, I'll kind of let that go again. So that's SQL databases. So it gives you a little bit of an idea how to create, provision, and manage your SQL databases, and you have to do the firewall rule thing, unless you're accessing from SQL and different things like that. So how does this actually work? How do they actually create a database service, right, that you can just use and not have to worry about load, elasticity, uptime, and all that other stuff? What they essentially have are a load balance set of TDS gateway nodes, right, that essentially create a transaction data service session, I believe that's called anyway. There's some sort of transactional session that basically is the manager of your query, right? When you are maintaining or running queries on your database, the database queries run against the backend primary node, but also get spread out into two replicas, right? So what essentially happens is that you automatically get two replicas created of any database changes that you make. And also, in a short amount of time, that database change is actually going to propagate itself to another data center as well, right? So that you actually have like really a ton of redundancy with your SQL data, right? That's much more redundancy than most people have in their own data centers. Right, and a disaster recovery plan, that's right. So SQL Federation is a feature that was implemented in SQL Azure first, and now it's made its way into SQL 2012 in a little bit of a different form. But it's primarily for, you know, having those large data structures that are on the cloud. And so it's essentially a way that you can help the Windows Azure team and the SQL Azure team scale out your table. So essentially you partition a table into federation pieces. So if you have like a multi-tenant environment, obviously one tenant is not going to care about the data from another, right? So you can actually say, well, really all of my queries are going to be specific to this one tenant. So I'm going to make a federation out of each of the tenants so that if you want to put them on different nodes and spread them out, that's fine. I don't care, right? I'm always only going to be querying on this one tenant. So it's essentially a way to take large table structures with very large sets of pages, SQL pages, and allow the SQL Azure team to kind of spread them out, right? And with minimal amounts of downtime. Like that. Isn't that cool? So there's a few other features that go along with SQL Azure. There's hosted SQL reporting. So you can actually run reports on SQL Azure databases. So reporting services is in the cloud. So now we're talking about data services and reporting services. One thing that's missing in Windows Azure right now is analysis services. You can't really have cubes. You can't really do analysis services in the cloud currently. But you can do some syncing processes, which I'm going to get into after this, if you wanted to do analysis on your data. But you can very easily create a SQL reporting instance based off of the one requirement for SQL reporting is that the database that it's reporting on has to be a SQL Azure database and not a SQL on Azure database. It actually has to be in the SQL Azure data service. If you are doing reporting on a SQL on Azure database, like a hosted infrastructure as a service database, then you'd probably start up another machine and install SQL reporting on there, or install SQL reporting on your primary virtual machine. So what other features do they actually have related to SQL Azure? You have SQL Azure Data Sync, which provides you the ability to say, I want this database data replicated on my on-premise database or even another Azure database that's in another data center. So you can actually use SQL Sync to say any updates to this database every hour will be propagated to any other databases or in a certain amount of time. It's not immediate replication like it is with their backup and clustering and failover, but it is some really good replication there. So this is something I don't usually do for the online folks or when we're being recorded, but I'm kind of making a switch now from the SQL side of things to the Azure side of things, and I need to rest my throat a little bit. So does anyone have any questions about SQL on Azure or SQL Azure? Feel free. Allie?
Is there a difference in the type of data I can store?
The question was, is there a difference between the type of data you can store between the two hosted SQL and SQL Azure? No, there isn't in the regular schema structure, right? All of the SQL types are there. However, SQL Azure doesn't support CLR types, so you can't actually have .NET types in your SQL. The reason for that is that if you've ever written a CLR type in a SQL database, you actually have to install that assembly on that machine's global assembly cache. Well, SQL Azure is any number of machines in any number of locations that it's impossible to install a custom assembly on all of those machines, or even all the machines that contain your data. So you can't have the CLR types. And like I was mentioning before, you can't have a file stream or that kind of capability as well. The question was, is there any power that you have over, your data existing in one country rather than another? Unfortunately not, but the one main thing is that whenever you are talking about a failover scenario, right, or actually replicates to another data server, it's replicating or another availability set or kind of another, oh, geez. Anyway, big building full of junk. anyway, so Data, yeah, data warehouse or something like that. So essentially, when it's replicating itself, it's always replicating to another data system in the same country or in the same continent. So for example, the only exception to that is in Europe, right? So in Europe, the three or so or four, I believe, maybe it's three, data centers is the word that I'm looking for. The three data centers are actually in different countries. So when it's replicating to other data centers, it's possibly going to be replicating or will be replicating to another country. Whereas in the US, if you're in the East data center, you're replicating to one of the other data centers in the US. You don't have control over which data center that is, right? And right now you don't have control over which data center that is, and don't have a lot of, you know, failover control. You know, the main thing is that when you choose to put your data on hosted on Windows Azure or on SQL Azure, you choose to, you know, use that country's data services, right? So you have to be aware of your requirements and contractual obligations around where your data actually lives and resides, right? One of the main things that I always talk about when people in Canada are concerned about this, what with the Patriot Act and all these other things, is that not all of the data is, you know, private data, right? There is a lot of extraneous extra data that is involved with an application that may not be related to actual citizen information, or you can kind of abstract and say this relates to a citizen, but SQL Azure doesn't know who that is, right? It has an ID or a GUID or something, right? So there are ways that you can kind of separate out the different like levels of your data, depending on where you want to house that data. And also just kind of avoiding the SQL Azure part of this in general, that it's all right if your data is actually in transit. So you can actually query or communicate with an on-premise data system that's on Canadian soil, but still transmit that data through web servers that are in the States, and it's still fine, as long as you're not caching it at all. So yeah, but that is a good question. It's something that I kind of talk about a lot.
I finally get asked it a lot.
Yeah, yeah, and Natalie is saying that he gets that question a lot too. And one of the other things, and this might maybe hopefully not too candid, but I have been talking to people about Patriot Act versus the CSIS acts that are in Canada and other ones that are in Europe and other countries in Europe. The Patriot Act is really tame, right? It's very, like, you have to go through a ton of hoops. They have to get lots of warrants and signatures and stuff, whereas other countries, that's not the case, especially not in Canada. Canada, they can just walk in and say, hey, give me that. You know, the Patriot Act, as much as people are concerned about it, and you have to kind of keep it in consideration, all in all, when you look at the overall global scope of this, it's actually probably it has the least amount of teeth of any of those data acts that are around the world. Hopefully that wasn't too candid. But I'm not a lawyer, so don't take my word for it. All right. So I'm going to move on. So we're actually going to be talking about Azure Table Storage and Azure Blob Storage. So now we're leaving the relational side behind, and we're looking at a little more of the fundamental data structures that can be used for very basic solutions, or even fairly complex solutions if you understand how they work and how to use them properly. So Windows Azure Storage. Azure Table Storage, Blob Storage, and actually Queue Storage are provided by the same underlying REST API, right? They're just abstractions over the same data storage, and they allow you to use the data storage in a variety of different ways. So when you sign up for a storage account on Windows Azure, you actually get all three endpoints for the different types of storage mechanisms, even though you may only be using one or two of them. They come as a package. So it's storage in the cloud. It can be accessed from anywhere. That's not to mean that you can just freely access it from anywhere and it's going to be a public connection and there's going to be anonymous access. You actually have to have a shared key, right, to access it, or a temporary shared access signature in order to access this data. So there are some authentication mechanisms that are in place. It's not just you have your data in the cloud, that means it's public. That'd be crazy. You can set up some of the things to be completely public. And definitely for public websites that have large media like movies and images, you want a public location to save your data that's has very high throughput. You can use Windows Azure Storage. All of the storage endpoints are RESTful web services. Has anyone ever dealt with like a RESTful API before? A couple people. RESTful APIs are HTTP based. They're very minimal barrier to entry because most other solutions support HTTP. And they've actually ported the SDK or API, let's say, of accessing web services or Azure services to a number of other languages like PHP, Java, and I think they even have a Perl one and like a variety of other languages. They've Python, yep. They've actually implemented access to Azure Storage. Yeah, that's what I was saying. So even some of the other ones like Common Lisp, Objective-C, a Windows Phone 7, which is a trimmed-down version of .NET. We'll have that on there. Some of the other ones that I missed, maybe Node, Erlang. I don't even know what that is. But they have one there. Does anyone know what this language is used for? Erlang? Okay. It's a language, So you can access these things. And if you don't actually have a library for these languages, the REST APIs is published online, and you can actually make the calls yourself. So what are some of the new features of Windows Azure Storage? If you haven't really looked at Windows Azure Storage, these are, everything's a new feature. But you can actually do expanded blob copy and improve blob leasing. So a blob lease is basically a lock saying that only people who provide this lease key can actually make changes or reads or any sort of activity to this blob. What they also implemented just recently is that you can have an option of a locally redundant storage or a geo and locally redundant storage. So when I was talking about SQL, there are copies of your data in the same data center and then another copy of your data in another data center. That's the same for this Windows Azure Storage. There are three actual copies of your data in a single data center, and then another copy in another data center when you choose the geo-redundant storage, which is chosen for you by default. But if you're doing something like logs or non-mission-critical data that's kind of sitting beside your application, you may not want to pay, you want to pay less to actually store that data, so you can go for a locally redundant storage option and say, you know what, if the data center blows up, which probably won't happen, but if it does happen, you still have the three copies in the one data center. It just doesn't geo-replicate it to another data center. So you have some redundant storage, some locally redundant storage. But if that data center explodes, forbid, then you have lost that data, essentially. And they have now and are continuing to add more and more metrics. You can actually configure a lot of really rich interactions of different transaction types and quantities in your application. How much time do I have, Atlee? Fifty minutes, great. So what does table storage look like? It's NoSQL, right? It doesn't have a strict structure. It's a fully managed platform as a service. It scales itself all that other stuff. So you have a storage account, you have a table name, and then you have an entities in the table. So one of the things that you can do is, you have customers with, if you notice, the first customer entity is name and email, and the second one says name and email add. That's not going to cause a problem, right? Because the columns don't actually have to be the same for the different rows. So you get a very flexible set of data. You kind of have to be aware that that's happening and maybe do a little bit of translating if you're upgrading your objects and different things like that. But you're not even you don't even need to store only one type of class in a certain table. You can throw any number of different types at the same table. And if they have some common table or column entries, yeah, it'll use the common column entries. But if they have extra ones on some types of entities and extra ones on others, each row can be very different from each other. No fixed schema. So you got one of the ways that it has no fixed schema is the birth date is formatted differently on each of them. Right? Hopefully you're taking that and translating them into a .NET type, and so they will be represented in the same way, but they're represented as strings, so they can be represented differently. And now you actually have another column that exists on one row and not on the others. So that was just a short introduction to table storage, and it's very easy to kind of set up a table storage account, but I only have a few minutes left, and I want to open it up for some questions. So I'll go on to blob storage. Blob storage is unstructured data storage. You have some pretty high limits. You have 100 terabyte per storage account limit. That's actually globally for all of the storage mechanisms per storage account. You have 100 terabytes to use, but most of those terabytes are going to be used in blob storage because it's meant for large objects. So here, when you have your account blob core Windows Net, then you have a container very similar to in the table storage. We had a table. Now we have a container called images, and underneath there we have a blob like pick one, pick two, and vid one, right? And you could actually have more slashes in there, kind of mimicking the idea of a directory, but directories don't technically exist, right? The blob name just includes forward slashes, which allows you to make a URL like you have directories and to structure your data like that, and you can actually page and query the data as if it were in directories, but the directories themselves don't really exist anywhere. So inside the container, there's just a set of blobs, and then per blob, you can actually split it up into blocks and pages. So a page is essentially, I don't know if I go into this. I don't think I'll go to do a demo. I'll just kind of talk about this for a little bit. So a page, when you're talking about a page blob, you have basically an array of 512 byte increments where you say that's the data in that section of the blob. And it's a fixed size for random reads and writes, very similar to an NTFS data structure, where you can actually, in some cases, you can actually mount virtual hard drives as page blocks and just use them as VHDs and have kind of a caching mechanism. But actually what the persistent VM roles, when you actually create a virtual machine in Windows Azure, it's actually using a page block for your virtual hard drive. In fact, I can show you what that looks like right here. So it created this Portal VHDs account. And if I go into containers and VHDs, so this is my blob account. And so I actually have a URL here that will show you, the random set of numbers and letters that is this account, blob.core@windows.net, VHDs, Tyler D, SQL, 2012, et cetera, et cetera. Right? So this is the actual .vhd file that represents the operating system that's on my virtual hard or my virtual machine, my SQL server. So I can attach another data disk that can sit right beside this one that will represent the data volume on my SQL server as well. So anytime you're adding virtual machines to or data disks to the virtual machines in Windows Azure, what you are really doing is creating a page blob and storing it in blob storage. Now, there's also a mechanism for, you don't necessarily have to know a lot about the page blobs and block blobs. You can still just manipulate the API and just save and get data, and it just figures it out for itself. It does best effort on, what kind, it mainly defaults to block blob first. And then if you want to be a little more precise about how you interact with that data, then you can say, give me a page blob kind of endpoint. Anyway, so a block blob is a little bit different. So you can choose and say what the chunk size is. So say you actually had a mobile device that is roaming in the middle of Bonuk nowhere, and you have very little data access, like you're in Winnipeg or something. And then nobody laughed at that? Come on. There you go. And so you basically say, I don't want to have to upload this file and then have it fail, and then try and upload the file again and then have it fail. All right, I want to kind of piece this thing up in a bunch of different blocks and then just upload them one at a time. And then periodically say, okay, you know, I can retry uploading certain blocks. So I can basically just take my blob and chunk it up and assign IDs to each of the blocks. And so I'm uploading the blocks or downloading the blocks one at a time. And at the very end of my process, I can just give them the whole list of IDs and say, I just gave you all these blocks. This is what order they go in. Right? This is the overall set of blocks that I've uploaded to you. Take them, put them in one blob. So it's really good for streaming. It's really good for uploads that may take a while and are on, you know, not very good internet connections, or are on very good internet connections where you can download them in parallel. Right? So you can have two streams or multiple streams or threads going at the same time and download and upload blocks in parallel using block blobs. So how does the storage architecture work? Now, every storage abstraction in the Windows Azure Storage account has a way that it partitions itself, right? So for queues, each queue is a partition. It can be split up to different machines. For blobs, each blob can be its own partition, right? So per storage account, they won't try and keep blobs on the same actual physical server, partition server, because there's no reason to. You're not really like querying and manipulating two blobs at once. You're only ever using one blob at once. The only exception to that rule is that you can snapshot blobs. You can say, "This I'm making a point in time snapshot of this blob, and the snapshots and the blob have to exist on the same server because they're technically just a snapshot of the same, you know, data." But table storage is a little bit different. So in table storage, let's see. There we go. In table storage, you actually have a partition, right? And per table, you don't just separate the tables into, you know, this table goes on that server, that whole table goes on this server, because the tables can get crazy big, like crazy large. So what you actually have in a table is a partition key. So the partition key, whenever that partition key is different, it tells the people at Windows Azure in their data center that you're okay if the different partition keys exist on different servers. So when you actually query for the data, if you query using the partition key, it doesn't have to go find the item on all the different servers. It goes, oh, you mean it's on that one, right? I'm going to go search on that server and run the query on that server. Whereas if you don't use a partition key, or your partition is too big and it has to split up your data through different servers because, you know, it's large, the system actually has to search both servers or all servers before it actually returns a response to you, which can affect your performance significantly. So using smart partition keys with your table storage can really help your performance, and where they can actually, you know, split up the partitions onto different servers. So when you're actually doing the query and you say, oh, I want, so let's say you have a product catalog and you have a product type like a bike, right? So you use the bike or the product type as the partition key, and you want to say that most of the time I'm not querying all the products. I usually have the certain type of product that I'm looking for. I usually know that what I'm looking for is a bike, right? Or it's a canoe, or it's a pair of skates, or whatever, or footwear. So when I use the partition key in the where clause, it knows that I'm going to actually be searching server 2, and it leaves server 1 and server 3 out of it. And it scales everything and moves it all around. So I was talking to you about the partition key. Partition key and row key being unique is very fast. Let's see. Now, the next option to that, which is a little bit hard to manage, you know, the partition key and row key kind of combination. But so it's not that hard, but some people don't like it. So they want to have their one unique key, right? So what I usually like to do is if I know that I can represent one unique value in a table, and I'm not really going to be querying over the entire set. Let's say it's user data. You know, there's a very common scenario where, we were talking about it earlier, where when they log in, we have to get the extra data related to that user, right? So if I put that user's ID in the partition key column, I'm only ever saying, give me the row with that partition key. And so I have a highly partitioned data set that they can spread out to any number of servers, but they know which one each of the users are on, right? So you can actually have, and you can just leave the row key blank, or you can put a zero in there, or a space, or an empty string. It doesn't matter, right? It's the combination of both the row key and the partition key that makes the unique identifier. Yeah, both of them form a single clustered index. And yeah, so if you have, but that is a little bit slower. The fastest is if you actually have a unique row key as well as a unique partition key. So I kind of said that we were done with Hadoop, but we're not done with Hadoop. What we actually hear here, this is talking about how it actually uses, Yeah, it uses a Hive ODBC driver. So it's a Hive system that actually spreads out the queries and spreads out the searching that uses a variety of algorithms that I don't even know what they are right now. But you can look them up, and they're really cool. And you know, they're very computer science-y way of doing data mining. If you're interested in that stuff, there's tons of documentation on Hadoop. I can point you in the right direction if you come and talk to me or send me an email. But I'm pretty sure that I'm pretty close, if not over already. So in summary, one of the great things that you can do with, or the great benefits of using Windows Azure or cloud storage, is that it's managed for you, right? Even if you need something as complex as a SQL instance, you can have a managed SQL instance that you don't have to worry about upgrading, failover, disaster recovery, scalability. All of that is taken care of for you, and you just have to worry about what data your application needs and how to put that data and how to, you know, cluster and separate that data together. And so that's the same way with a lot of the cloud storage and stuff like that. It provides all those storage abstractions that are crucial to your application, like file storage, unstructured table storage, queue storage, right? But in a highly scalable and available manner. And because you have so many options, everything from NoSQL down to just saving a file, it's the cloud on your terms, right? You get to choose and pick and choose what you want to do. So personally, when I'm looking at structured storage like table storage, I always start with putting things in table storage, mainly because I'm cheap. SQL Azure is a little bit more expensive than in table storage. Most people, when they're looking at large implementations, they would say that it's nothing, right? Like, earlier, Mark was talking about Pottermore. Pottermore is a website that's hosted on Windows Azure that uses SQL Azure, and they have tons of servers. They get hit millions of times a day, and they have a huge amount of SQL sitting in behind of SQL Azure in there. They don't even blink at the cost, right? The cost of their compute time is much, much more than their database. So lots of people say, well, SQL Azure is really expensive. Overall, when you scale it up, it's not that expensive, right? Getting a highly available and scalable SQL instance on your own, the amount of money in support that that costs is ridiculous, right? Compared to actually having a triple replicated plus geo replicated structure in SQL Azure. Anyway, so this is probably something you've seen all day. We are using Poll Everywhere for our session evaluations. This is basically saying that they don't collect any of your data. If you go to the session evaluations, it only asks you two radio button questions, so there's no way they can get any of your data. And the eval for this session is at wapi.ca/cld6eval. So this is the sixth session of the evaluation, so please take some time, 2 seconds, even you in the green shirt. Maybe not. To do the evaluations. And come on, I had to do that. And so And you know, give me your feedback. That's really, really great, and we can use it for numbers and stuff like that. So definitely fill out your session evals. And this has been a Microsoft presentation. And anyway, so we'll probably cut the online feed, and we'll leave it online for right now, and we'll open it up for questions. So does anybody have any questions about data in the cloud? We already answered some questions about SQL, but anything about table storage or blob storage? Nope. Ready to get in there? Yep. Like I was saying before, like when I, if you're looking at, I always relate it to what do you currently use on-premise. What would you use if you were the building the application and you were installing it in your own server? Would you use SQL Azure? Would you use a file system? Would you use a third-party data storage or like a simple data storage mechanism? So if you had a folder and you save files into that folder, right, large files like movies and stuff like that, then you're looking at blob storage because it's a file system in the cloud. If you're looking at, now the tricky part is when you're actually looking at tabular data, right, tables and columns and stuff like that. If it's just flat columns of just lots of data, maybe logs or, you know, tweets or whatever, they don't really relate to each other very much, then definitely go with table storage because the lack of foreign keys and relational integrity is not going to hurt you very much. Right? But if relational integrity is really a big deal for your data structure, then you're going to have to go to SQL. And honestly, for those that are creating websites and creating other things on the platform as a service infrastructure, and if you're creating a whole new application, don't go to SQL on Azure. Right? SQL on Azure is for porting applications, installing, you know, Microsoft products like SharePoint in the cloud, and it's really good for that kind of stuff. If you're building new and you just need a database, just create a SQL Azure database, right? You don't need to create a VM. That just is going. You're going to incur a whole lot of cost and support costs in maintaining that VM, maintaining the version of SQL that's running on that VM, and also using one of your licenses, right? So even in the licensing alone, you're probably better off using SQL Azure, licensing costs alone. Not to mention the actual, you know, like. Hosting costs of the virtual machine. So I know it's kind of a tough thing, right? Because you have to kind of, what I usually do is I try table storage until I am forced into SQL Azure, right? If I need transactions, if I need really complex locking, read locks and write locks and stuff like that, and you know something that a stored procedure would do very well, then I would go to SQL Azure, right? But if I have a chat application where people are just throwing messages and they're messaging different people, I would just throw that into table storage, right? Because it's a lot of bulk data. Did that answer your question a little bit at least? Yeah, great. Yes. Yeah. That's right, no. So what the question we're highlighting is the cheapest option is the storage accounts and the table, the Azure storage subscriptions, but you can't run SQL Azure. You're not really getting an Azure or a SQL system, right? It's non-relational. It's just a REST API, right? So you're just calling a data service and throwing OData at it. And it's actually an OData REST API, right? So you just throw a bunch of OData XML at this service, and it takes care of saving it. It's very simple, right? But it's also very flexible. Okay, are there anything else? Random things? This is my last session of the day. I'm going back to Winnipeg tonight. Questions? Probably not a whole lot. You probably just need a client that you can upload and download storage onto blob storage. The question was, what would it take to create a personal photo storage service? Now, that being said, there are some clients, even some that I don't remember the names of right now, but you can probably search like Azure Cloud Storage Explorer or something like that. There's even some clients that are free right now that will allow you to sync folders to blob storage containers, right, and automatically know which, you know, which checksum or which e tags match or what the modified data is of a file, and they'll sync that to cloud storage. So something like that is what you might look for. There's also some services or an application that you can install on your machine to mount a cloud storage container as a network drive. Right, so that might be interesting for you too. It's a little bit buggy sometimes, but it's a good start into, you know, integrating cloud storage into your system. You can't really mount it as a virtual hard drive, because the only reason they can do that in the cloud is they are very, very close, and they have a huge, massive amount of network bandwidth between storage services and the roles and the compute stuff. Right, you do not have that kind of bandwidth. So you can't mount it as a real drive, but you can get a network drive out of it. Yes? Right. So the question is, what if you have to mix data types? So something like a large file, like a photo, and then some other extraneous data, like metadata. If you want to, you can put custom metadata on the blob. So you can get a little bit of data out of there. So like if you're saving photos and you want to save what camera you took that photo with, you can say camera. It's just a dictionary, basically, of extra metadata. So the problem with that is that you get the data along with the blob when you're querying the blob, but that's not, you know, that doesn't provide you with a table that you can query. Like you can't really say, find all of the ones that I took with my Samsung camera, right? Because blob metadata is not queryable. Now, for the solution like that, where you actually have a photo, but also want to keep records of all of the photos, then you would essentially put a table storage together, right, a images table, and one of your columns would just be blob URI, right? So you just take that, you know, storageaccount.core.windows.net/this container/this blob name, and then throw it right into a table column, right, as a string. So when you're retrieving that data, you can say, okay, great, I have all of the extraneous information about this image. Now I actually want to go get the image. I know where it is, it's in this blob, right? And then you just use that URL to go download it. Does that kind of answer your question? Great. All right, yeah. No, the question was, if you have table storage or a storage account and you have nothing in it, are they charging you? No, they're not, right? There is no service that's sitting online just for you. Unlike SQL Azure, if you create a SQL Azure database, like the ones that I was creating right now, I'm going to go delete them because you pay by the hour for, you know, it drills down to per, I think it's 100 megs, right? They'll charge you. Right. Yeah, but the storage accounts, I have probably 11 or 12 completely empty storage accounts, and I don't pay for them. Even if you have a few bits of data in them, and you may have an MSDN subscription, with an MSDN subscription, you get either 30 or 40, depending on the subscription, gigs of free storage space in those Azure storage accounts. And when you're, so with the storage accounts, you're paying for two things. You're paying for storage, or three things. You're paying for the amount of storage that's actually sitting on there. You're paying for the amount of transactions that actually occur to that storage account, right? And you're also paying for the bandwidth of the data that's going through that storage account. So the storage and the bandwidth are very, very minimal. We're talking about like 6 cents for a gig of bandwidth. Like, it's ridiculously small. And storage transactions is about 2 cents for every 500,000 storage transactions. Like, it's ridiculously small. Obviously, if you have a very heavy application that has like 10, 20 worker roles and web roles, they're all hitting the storage account, your transaction counts are going to start going up and up and up. And you can turn on some monitoring service to see what kind of transactions are heavy load transactions on your system. And you can, you know, it's the one time that as a developer, you can actually say to your project manager, refactoring this code actually saved you money. Like, usually when you go into an application or you know, a project like the ones that I usually work on, project managers and the people that pay the bills, they don't like refactoring. They think it's a waste of time, right? there is a lot of things that, you know, it helps with, like maintainability, and but they're all just like fuzzy savings. This is concrete savings. If you can reduce the amount of transactions, you can batch table transactions in the same table. So if you're deleting all of the entries in the same table and you're just doing one operation, like a delete, you can batch that operation and say do all of that at once, and that's one transaction. Right? It but so it has to be on the same partition key, and it has to be the same operation on the same table. Right? And then that those transactions can get batched. So if you start implementing proper partition keys and proper batching, you can save yourself transactions and save yourself some money. Great. So I think it might be over. I don't even know what time it is. And I'm very happy that all you guys are here, and there are great questions. If you have any more questions or want to talk to me, I'm going to be around for a bit. And I think we're going to go into the keynote to see some people's applications, or over there maybe. Thanks very much, and I hope you have a great day. Thanks.